Great to see so many people. We have a lot of visitors and grateful for your presence here. Ray Conies, could you lead us in a prayer as we start our class?
Let's pray. Father, thank you that we're able to be here today, study your word. And we ask you to be with us as we center our minds on the things concerning you, and that you've provided for us, and you provided a teacher for us today in this room who will lead us and help us to be good students. And Father, ultimately, be more faithful and obedient and ultimately, Father, led to that path of salvation to be with you eternally. And be with all of us, and thank you for the visitors that are here today with us, and ask the same blessing for them that we all learn together. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
So I want to remind you of two frameworks to continue to place on the book of Genesis, really about anywhere you're at, especially from Genesis 12 onward, anywhere you're at. And I think it helps with some of the thorny issues that we encounter in the book of Genesis regarding the behaviors of people. First of all, keep in mind that Genesis 1 to 2 depicts the world that God made. But Genesis 3 onward depicts the world that humans made. We see problematic issues like men having multiple wives. And that term wife is liberal. It's a very loose kind of definition of wife. We see that people are oftentimes dishonest and deceitful. And that there are a lot of inequitable relationships. That there are people exercising, leveraging power over one another in a way that, especially in our modern sensitivities, are quite troubling to us. But keep in mind, from Genesis 3 onward, this is a world that man has made. God is allowing people to make choices, and those choices are often bad choices. But remember what this year is about. Kim, can you talk about that and help me a little bit? Thank you. And that is, we're looking at these ancient people, but ultimately we're trying to see God. That is always to be our focus. And so that's one framework. Keep that in mind. And that helps us with some things that are going on, all the way from Lot's daughters to Noah's behavior at the very end, to some things even Abraham is doing and Sarah's are doing, both of them. And the other framework is that from Genesis 12 onward, is that all the things that are unfolding in the shadow of the promises made to Abraham in Genesis 12. That he would provide for Abraham and bless his descendants and make his name great and bring a blessing to all families of the world, all nations of the earth, in the descendant of Abraham. So everything that's unfolding is in light of that, from Genesis 12 really to Genesis 50. And that's why we've got this framework here. It's the foundational history of the Hebrew people from Genesis 12 to Genesis 50. Because the Hebrew people will be this platform that God will use to unfold his plan and provide a savior for all of mankind. So let's go to Genesis 20 and 21 this morning and highlight some of the things that are happening in these two chapters. And here we go with problematic behavior among these people, especially those claiming to be faithful to God. And here of all people, it's Abraham. So Genesis chapter 20. Rick, can you read verse 1 and 2 for us, please?
Now Abraham journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. Then he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah.
All right, thank you. Let's talk about Abraham, his location, his movements. There are two reasons why Abraham moves around. One is theoretical, and the other one is practical. Why is he moving around?
Livestock.
He's got livestock. And we're used to livestock being raised in a fenced-in area, but for most of human history, and certainly at this time in this place, it's nomadic shepherding and herding. They've got to move around, especially the resources being limited as they were. What's a more big picture reason why he's not staying in one place? What does he own in Canaan?
Nothing.
Later on, he'll own a burial spot. That's all. And why does he not own anything?
He's not.
That doesn't stop us, does it?
Huh? God told him to survey the land.
As God told him to do this, because God is going to give this land, not to him, not even to his son, not even to his grandson, but to the descendants that will come later on. His whole lifestyle is lived in faith of what's going to happen in the future. So, before we're too hard on Abraham in chapter 20 here, let us keep in mind, and that's what the sermon is going to be about today, what this man was called to do, what he's asked to do. It's a big lift. So, let's talk about his movements here. This is a physical map of Canaan. We've really been working this over the last several weeks on Wednesday night in our geography class. And the area that's described here where he's migrating now is this southern Canaan area, and especially where the central highlands play out. And so it's fascinating how that geographically, the events that are happening in the highlands, in the hills, and the events that are happening outside the hills in the plains or the lowlands, they match sort of, you know, God's providence and what's going on here. Whenever the Israelites later on, the descendants of Abraham, are in the highlands, they're pretty safe and they're secure. But it's when they get outside of that that they're exposed to other peoples, and sometimes that's a bad outcome. But he is down in here in this area, this lower Canaan area, and that does two things. First of all, he's out of the hills, which certain times of the year, that's where you want to be with flocks and herds, practically. So Abraham tends to hover around two areas, the southern Canaan area and up here in this upper highlands area north of later on what will be called Jerusalem. And there would be probably some practical reasons why he's taking his herds even at times in, even into the hills. And this is where he encounters this king of Gerar, Abimelech. So back to this right here. Abimelech is actually, from all indication, a royal title. It's not the name of a man, though it reads like that in the text, because we run into a couple of Abimelechs. It's similar to the Egyptian title, Pharaoh. And Pharaoh did this, and this happened to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said that, when there are different pharaohs. Or later on in Roman times, Caesar. So Abimelech is really a royal title, and Abraham encounters him. And what is it? He takes Sarah. Okay. What's going on with all this? Well, first of all, this is similar to an earlier incident found back in Genesis 12. What am I referring? With Pharaoh. So they migrate down to Egypt, and Pharaoh takes Sarah because he sees she's beautiful. Here we see Abimelech doing the same thing. Now, what is going on here? Now, back in chapter 12, both in verse 11 and 14, there's an emphasis on her beauty. She was a looker. Good-looking women ran in this family, evidently. Not all of them, but there are comments made about this. It's interesting how chapter 20 does not emphasize that. It's not about her appearance. That's left out. And this is a few years later, by the way. So what's going on here? Why is this Abimelech interested in Sarah, who he thinks is Abraham's sister? First of all, understand lifespan. She's at this time about 75 years old. But understand that her lifespan is going to be 127. So it's possible that she doesn't look quite as, you know, that she has the miles that, say, maybe a 75-year-old person would today. But here's the thing. Abimelech was the king of this territory. And ancient kings tended to do things like this. Now, we're looking at approximately 1,500 years later, we see the Persian Empire and we see the account of Esther. But if you recall the account of Esther with Ahasuerus, he is looking for a new queen and he just surveys and he does the processes and he picks one. And it doesn't look like Esther has much of say-so in that. So I think that is indicative of how that ancient kings, if they ruled an area and they saw a woman they wanted, they took it. They took the woman. But here's something else that we're seeing happening with Abraham. By this time, what's happening to Abraham in this region? Think about the Lot incident, etc. He's getting richer. He's got a reputation. He's rising in prominence. Now, we understand this in the flow of the Old Testament. We understand this in ancient times. Powerful groups of people form alliances in what way?
Marriage.
I mean, that's what was probably behind Solomon's marriages to all those different foreign people. And so here's Abraham, a wealthy, powerful man. And it would be very advantageous for Abimelech to marry his sister. And thus they would form an alliance. Makes perfect sense. There's only one problem with this. Sarah's already married. Thank you for all these young people sitting here, and Frank has to carry the load. Okay. Thank you. She's already married. So what's going on here? Why does Abraham do this? So let's keep reading this. Rick, keep reading for us. Verse 3 to 7. 3 to 7.
But God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is married." Now Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, wilt thou slay a nation even though blameless? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours."
All right, let's not miss the obvious here. Again, we're looking at ancient people, but we're really trying to see God, right? Do we understand this, that God was known by a lot of people besides Abraham and his descendants? God's not hiding himself from the population at large. Now, he has a unique relationship, and he gives Abraham a unique calling, as he will Isaac and Jacob. But here, Abimelech addresses him as Lord. This is Yahweh. And he and his people are aware that if this woman's already married, that what he's married, then what he's going to do is what? It's wrong. It's guilt. It's an offense. It's interesting, morality is not a complicated thing. Most civilizations pretty much end up in the right spot on it. And so there's this awareness of God, this awareness of what is proper regarding Sarah and those kinds of things. So, and watch for that. We see it in other examples in Genesis and Exodus. It's not just the Hebrew family that knows something about God. Now, they know more about him than others, but God is known. Now, there are two problems with this, with Abimelech taking Sarah to be his wife, although we learn that he does not, you know, go through with this. It's not consummated and so forth. But there are two problems with him taking her as a wife. The first one we just mentioned, the immorality of it. But there's another problem. Go ahead. I can read it on your face. You better shine bright today.
It's going to interfere with God's plan to bring about the Messiah through Abraham and his people.
This is not God's plan, is it? God's plan is for Abraham and Sarah to have a child. Now you're thinking, at Sarah's age, is she going to have a child naturally? No, she's not going to have a child naturally. That's the whole point of it. But she's supposed to be Abraham's wife. And Abraham's is supposed to produce an heir through her. And this is just going to mess the whole thing up. And that's the other big problem here. And in the scheme of things, the big scheme of things, that's the big problem. And so this is another example of how humans are trying to tug things one direction, and that direction's away from the plan of God. And that's just such a really good theme for us from Genesis 12 to 50. And we'll talk about that later here in different things. And I want you to see something. God comes to Abimelech. And this is, he's doing Abimelech a favor, is he not? He's giving him a warning. He's trying to redirect Abimelech. And to his credit, how does Abimelech react? Yes, I'll do it. Yes, sir. Whatever you command me. He's very obedient in this, isn't he? And I want you to see that God, in dealing with these events that are happening, and this is an example of it, is he's just in dealing with people's behavior. If Abimelech goes through with this, he's going to hold him accountable. Abimelech's going to suffer if he goes through with this. But he's gracious to Abimelech by doing what?
Speaking to him in a dream.
Speaking to him, giving him a heads up, giving him a chance to do the right thing here. He's not guilty yet, so he's trying to prevent that. So watch how that, you know, there's this never-ending debate that has manifested itself in different ways about God's control of things and human choice. And the whole doctrine of Calvinism, hammered out centuries ago, is a human attempt to reconcile all that, which ends up in a non-biblical place. But the bottom line is, this is a difficult subject. God's in control, but humans are making choices. Well, how can you have both? Well, we do. It's a paradox. And so watch how that people make choices, even bad choices. But God herds the situation. He steers the situation in the direction he wants it to go so his plan is fulfilled. And here he's very active. He's very direct in doing that by backing Abimelech off of Sarah. All right? Observations? Questions on that so far?
My only thought is, what's Abraham thinking?
You know. We'll get into that. That's where we're headed next. Vince?
Yeah, you're saying about the, God is in control, but yet he allows us to make our choices. Just like in verse 7 there, he says, but if you do not restore her, know that surely you would die and all with you. So he has a choice to go right or right.
Very clear. Yeah. Right there. You just have to get comfortable with that paradox. All right, so to Rick's question, what is Abraham thinking here? Well, look at Abraham's explanation that really doesn't have a justification, but it's an explanation. Ken, can you read that for us, 8 to 13, please?
So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us, and how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done. And Abimelech said to Abraham, what did you see that you did this thing? Abraham said, it was because I thought, there is no fear of God in all of this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, this is the kindness you must do to me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother.
All right, thank you very much. So, Abimelech basically goes to Abraham and says, what did I do to deserve this? I was almost wiped out because I, you know, was going to take Sarah. And the bottom premise, the basic premise of Abraham's action here was that what? He's fearful. Fearful of his life. Now, Abraham, and I'm going to elaborate on this in the sermon today. Abraham is far along with God regarding these promises. And God has been reiterating these promises for a while with him, of which at the center of them that Abraham would produce an heir that would be a blessing to all people, etc. But there's no heir yet. And should Abraham have feared for his life in this moment? Coldly reading this text, we would say, no, because we know what's going to happen. We can flip ahead one page over and see what's going to happen. Okay? Abraham couldn't do that. So let's be reasonable with him. But here's the other thing, too. He makes an assumption. He says, there's no fear of God in this place. What have we seen about Abimelech and his people? Abimelech listened to God. And when they found out that Sarah already was married to Abraham, they were backing off of this. They had an awareness of the propriety here between Abraham and Sarah they had with each other. So, you know, fear does that, doesn't it? Fear causes you to miscalculate, misjudge things. Fear is one of the worst things we can have. Okay.
I mean, the thing is, Abraham's already been through this before. He did this in Egypt and caused horrible plagues to come on Egypt because of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems strange that he would keep doing this over and over and over again. And then even Isaac starts doing it.
Right. Yeah. And I just don't get it. We never make the same mistakes over and over, do we?
Well, it came out on the winning end both times.
Right. And that's it. That's it. And there's both this, like Becca's observed here, this, what is going on? But also this, well, we do that too. There's a little bit of a comfort there. It's not a justification, but it's a comfort there that this is how people struggle. Again, more on the sermon on that. But I want you to see this pattern. The patriarchs, we see this with Abraham. We see it with Isaac. We see it with Jacob. We see it with Jacob's sons. The patriarchs, we see it with Rebekah. The patriarchs deceitfully scheme certain times. And they're doing that to save their neck or to get what they want. Or to try to nudge God's plan along because they don't think it's going as it should go. And when they do so, each occasion, they're putting the plan in jeopardy. They're jeopardizing it. But God in his control and God in his grace steers things. Sometimes he has to just directly intervene, like with Abimelech. Other times he sort of steers the events so it doesn't go haywire. So it's fascinating what's happening here. Don't get so distracted with Abraham, Sarah, and Jacob. Keep seeing God in all this. Jesse and then Rick.
Well, Jesse. I think the other thing is you're seeing Abraham grow at this point.
Right.
This is not the Abraham who's willing to sacrifice Isaac because he knows that God's going to bring him back. You're still seeing an Abraham who doesn't have total faith yet, who is still struggling with it.
Gotta let people grow. Gotta let them grow when you read the text. You gotta let them grow around you too. And you want them to let you grow.
Well, and the sense of morality of mankind is not really fully developed yet. I mean, they don't have the Ten Commandments. The only verbal instruction they have from God about anything is circumcision in terms of that. And I think this is all, you know, their conscience that God has given them based on a lot of these things. So a lot of these things, I mean, there's probably in their minds, yeah, this is okay.
Well, maybe. I mean, the people of Gerar seem to have a sensitivity when they find out she's already married. But then we find other incidents and pockets where people are doing grotesque things. All right, Daryl covered Sodom and Gomorrah last week, right? Y'all did have class last week, right? I was gone. Make sure you did what you're supposed to do, so. I mean, look at Sodom and Gomorrah. Look how messed up that was. So, you know, people are complicated. These people are just like us. They really are. So, just scan verse 14 to 18. What happens next here? Well, I'm sorry, we haven't finished with Abraham. Was Abraham lying when he says, she's my sister? That statement is not a lie. But the way he's depicting the relationship, was he honest? No. She's his sister, but more importantly, she's his wife. And so you see a lot of marriage of half-sisters and half-siblings and cousins in the book of Genesis. So Speaking of the young people here today, maybe that puts a new complexion on the family reunion this summer. But things were just looked at differently back then. And she does him this favor, so he's protected. So Abraham is leaning on a deception to protect himself. On whom should he be relying? On God. He's got to learn that. Yeah.
That's interesting. In this case, he's expecting his wife to protect him. He's relying on his wife to protect him rather than relying on God to protect him.
Yeah, that's interesting. And let me tell you, the book of Genesis is incredible literature. It is incredible literature, these characters and what plays out here. It's a masterpiece. And you just have to, when we run into these incidents, we just finished reading Joseph's story. Does that ever get old? The Joseph story never gets old, does it? So look down at verse 14 to 18. What does Abimelech do besides not marrying, not taking in Sarah's wife? What does Abimelech do? Yeah, he gives all these gifts to Abraham. He just lavishes him with these things. What does Abraham do in return? He blesses him. So one of the things that's emerging with Abraham is not just his wealth, his prestige, but that Abraham has a relationship with God that is unique.
God calls him a prophet.
He calls him a prophet right here. And could we even say that in a sense, when you look at Abraham, and especially Abraham and Jacob's life, okay, it's almost like a priestly role. So it's almost like previewing the priesthood in a way. So fascinating. And again, it's Abraham's position. Look how it's portrayed. He's got influence. He's got power. He's got wealth. He's just becoming greater and greater, as God had promised that he would. Okay, now let's look at the thing that is, there we go. Let's look at verses 1 to 7. Got to make sure that we look at this. Rachel Messer, can you read verse 1 to 7 for us, please?
Then the Lord took note of Sarah, and he said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called his name, the name of the son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age.
All right, thank you. Big turning point, right? I've been waiting for this a long time. But I want you to observe something else. This is not just a major turning point in the flow of events in the book of Genesis. There is a dramatic and emotional element to this. Finally, that baby is born. And the text highlights emotion. And we'll analyze the laughter here a little bit more in a moment. But the Bible's got tons of information. But the Bible is not merely meant to be informative. I mentioned literature a while ago. You need to experience the Bible as a piece of literature. It's still inspired of God. But if God's going to write something, now come on, it's going to be written well. And there is an emotional element and a dramatic element to the narrative. And you see that right here, this baby being born. Babies being born are just an incredible experience. It's just, you know, you have your own children, and then years later you have grandchildren. It's like you just revisit the whole excitement again. And it's just an amazing thing. And of all births, what a birth. Abraham was how old? 100, which means, according to Genesis 17:17, and you calculate the years, Sarah is 90. Now, Sarah's going to live to be 127. But the text is clear that she's past childbearing age. 90 and 100. I mean, that's just, it's a good thing they have a lot of servants. It's going to take a village, right? And then there's the laughter. What's the role of the laughter here? Think about that. Earlier, and you probably covered this last week in Genesis chapter 18, when the heavenly visitors came to see Abraham and predicted the coming of the child a year later, Sarah laughed about her having a child and then denied she laughed. In that first case, back in Genesis 18, when Sarah laughed, what was that kind of laughter?
Disbelief.
Doubt. Mocking. I mean, there's some things you're like, oh, that's not going to happen. Other things that are so outlandish, you're like, ha, like that's going to happen. It's humorous. It's so outlandish that it causes you to laugh. It's an extreme thing, so you have an extreme reaction, you have an emotional reaction. This laughter in Genesis 21 is what kind of laughter?
Amazement and joy.
A joy. Astonishment. It's tinged with excitement and joy. Who would have thought this? Who would have thought this? That's what she's saying there in chapter, in verse 7. And so it's a literary device. The laughter. Sarah laughs. And by the way, what's Isaac's name mean?
He laughs.
He laughs. So.
Her friends will laugh with her, not at her.
Yeah. It's like a rejoicing. Yeah. They all enjoy it. And of course, what would have been the array of emotions? So we've already uncorked it. The laughter. So there's going to be an array of emotions in this moment. What are they? Joy? Astonishment? Gratitude?
Relief.
Yeah. I don't think we're to expect that pregnancy was like some exceptional pregnancy and she didn't have the typical things that women have when they're pregnant. It's a hard condition. Relief. Yeah. Just amazed at what's happened here. That, and now think about this. We're looking at these people, but we really should be looking at God. Look what God did. This is just a remarkable thing. And watch for that. I'm going to mention that in the sermon today. There are several untimely births in the Bible. And they're always connected to some critical juncture and some critical person coming along. And so it is here. And then there's the Ishmael situation. So let's look at this here. We got more laughing going on. So look down in Genesis 21. Look at verse 8 to 14. Joe, can you read that? 21, 8 to 14, please.
The child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." The matter distressed Abraham greatly because of his son. But God said to him, Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her, for through Isaac your descendants shall be named. And of the son of the maid I will make a nation also, because she is your descendant." So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and skin of water and gave them to Hagar, putting them on her shoulder, and gave her the boy and sent her away. And she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba.
All right. Thank you very much. What does Ishmael do on the celebration of the weaning of Isaac? Not sure when the weaning is. I mean, I don't know if anybody really knows. It's later than in modern times. He's probably a small child, maybe 4 or 5, something like that. I don't think we can know for sure. So, but what does Ishmael do? What's he doing in the middle of the celebration?
Mocking.
Okay. New American Standard say mocking. Okay. English Standard says laughing, but that word in the Hebrew implies a mocking laughter. It's a different kind of laughter than what we saw earlier in this chapter. It's a mocking laughter. You're laughing at someone, not with someone. The difference. And another literary device.
We saw that today. We would say that he's, I'm going to get the word out.
Yeah, he's misbehaving. He's bragging.
He's practicing. And they're making fun of him.
Yeah, he's making fun of him. Yeah, that's what's implied here, is that he's mocking him, right? And look at this literary device in a matter of just a few lines of laughter. There's different kinds of laughter and how it's being used here. You got one that's the celebration laughter at the arrival of Isaac, and the other one is the son of the slave laughing at the son of the promise. So when this happens, what's Sarah's response? Get rid of Hagar and the son. Get them out, okay? And this troubles Abraham, but God affirms to him that this is what you ought to do. Still things going on between Sarah and Hagar, right? Before she tried to get rid of her. Which is ironic, because what's triggering the tension between Sarah and Hagar is the birth of Ishmael, and then now the birth of Isaac. But whose idea was it for Hagar to get involved in this business? Sarah's. Okay? And that's just how she's responding. Now, recall this. Recall what Ishmael represented. Ishmael represented Sarah's attempt to do what?
Force God's hand.
Right? Provide an heir. Provide an heir. The heir's not coming, so I can't have the child, so let's get the handmaid to produce the child through Abraham. Sarah's going to fix this and fulfill the need for an heir. And I want you to see that this is very long-reaching, this incident right here. There must be now two distinct families. Ishmael and Hagar have to go out on their own, and God takes care of them. But there has to be two different households, because they're going to produce two different people. And in the long run, this is going to represent something. No matter the motives of Sarah and the misbehavior of people in this, God is working through this. Now, I'm going to give you a little teaser, because I started studying for this the last couple weeks. On Wednesday nights, the next quarter, we're going to do a study of the law of Moses. Don't groan. We're not going to get bogged down in Leviticus, but we're going to look at the law of Moses, big picture, in the Old Testament, in the scheme of things. And we'll look at some passages in Galatians. But we'll see the New Testament make this point. These are two mothers and two sons. One was the son of the promise, which was created by God's miraculous act, God's miraculous provision. The other one is a natural-born son to a slave woman. And we'll see that one represents man's attempt to save himself, man's attempt to pull off something great. The other one will represent letting God do it. In the book of Galatians, and other parts of the New Testament, make the point, man cannot be justified by works of the law, or the law. You got to let God save you. By their scheming, these humans couldn't produce their own heir. They had to let God do it. You can't save yourself. You got to let God do it. Does that mean you don't cooperate? You better cooperate. But God has to save you. It has to be according to His plan and His divine act. And so this becomes an allegory. This little story here becomes representative of how humans have two choices about being justified before God: their own works, their own schemings, or God's salvation. So we'll see that in the coming months on Wednesday nights. But God provides for Ishmael, takes care of him. And in verse 20 and 21, how is Ishmael depicted as he grows up? On his own, you know, in his own direction. How's he depicted in verse 20 and 21, at the end of the chapter? He's an archer. He's a warrior. He's skilled. You know, the archer means could mean two things, just like it does today. It can mean a weapon, but it also can mean provision of food. So he can take care of himself. That's the point. He's no wimp. How else is he depicted in verse 20 and 21? Does he thrive or does he what?
In the wilderness.
Yeah. Right. Right. What'd you say, Vince?
God is with them.
Yeah, God's with them. This is all unfolding according to God's plan. Yeah.
Rachel. One of the comments that was made earlier was allowing people to grow. It says a lad grew. Yeah, he was 14 years old when he was mocking. Yeah. You know, Joseph is called a boy at the age of 17. Men weren't numbered for war till they were, 20? And the girl who was raised from the dead was 12, and she's called a little girl. I think in our society, we tend to force current things on kids are very streetwise early today, but they're not grown. And we need to be careful with young people because of that. Also, to your point about Sarah and being blessed and everything kind of, God flipped everything over. God is the one who will take care of things, and we've got to trust in him. But he also avenges her here. And he says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Paul said it's only just that God repay those who persecute you. So God avenged her too. She didn't need to worry about that. And God also blessed her when she did what was right and kept trusting in him. He took care of what needed to be taken care of. We trust in governments and politics and all kinds of things. We need to trust God, and we need to let him have his place as the avenger and the one who sees to the future.
All these things are happening as God wills them to happen. No matter how much agitation the humans have in it, it's going to go the way he wants it to go. And he wants to bless Ishmael and his descendants. There's a purpose in that. But they're to be distinct people. But keep seeing God accomplishing his purposes, because that elevates God. He's in control of all of this. Okay, thank you very much. We'll keep rolling here next week.